This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this March. Breakdowns of every region and every game, who are the Cinderellas, and which team's cutting down the nets. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben Standing's with us, as he is every Monday and Friday, at Ben Standing on X on Twitter. He writes for The Athletic. It's easy and very inexpensive to subscribe, and it's worth it. You can also listen to Ben's podcast. It is called Last Man Standing. We'll talk some Washington football here shortly, but you know, you were certainly involved in watching the basketball and following the events of the week. We talked on Monday, but I actually gave you credit because you texted me last night and mentioned Billy Donovan. Like, that would be somebody I think I'd be thrilled with, but you know, he'd have to want to come back to college basketball. But give me your overall thoughts on Maryland's loss, the Maryland situation, and who you'd want to come in and coach the Terps if Kevin leaves.
Sure. Well, I mean, in terms of the game, like, you know, I'm not breathing it every day the way you are and so many people I know in my life. But, you know, when you tell me you basically have a 5-man lineup and the bench has no scoring, you know, that's a tough place to be when, you know, if your guys are, you know, your main guys are off, and, you know, not only were a couple guys slow to get going, but, you know, they were just getting, you know, hammered on the boards, as has been the case over the last few weeks. And when you're playing five guys, and they have two bigs, obviously really good ones, but the other three are, you know, guards more or less, and you know, nobody was, you know, collectively they just couldn't get it done on the board. So I don't know how much the Kevin Willard of it all played a factor in, you know, the team's spirit or whatever, but you know, Florida just had a lot of depth, and you know, I'm not surprised that they lost, but the rest of it is just so unbelievably crazy that it played out the way that it did. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to Willard in the sense that, you know, Maryland, financial reasons have seemingly held Maryland back for some time now. That's why they went to the Big Ten. It's been a while. And so I get that, like, he's frustrated, but, you know, dude, airing it out the way that he did just made it so much more dramatic. And, you know, I'm sure for so many fans, you know, how do you celebrate this Sweet 16 appearance, something you've been, you know, waiting for a few years now, and the whole time it's like, yeah, but this is happening. So ironically, Kevin, I didn't tell you were Denton, but I'm actually at College Park right now. Maryland football's having their pro day.
Yeah.
So I decided to come out here just to watch that. And, you know, obviously on the sideline, there's a lot of, you know, for those who are aware, a lot of talk about, you know, what's going to happen here. No definitive answers. I haven't seen, you know, and any of the rumored coaches, but here at the pro day. But yeah, obviously it's kind of all anybody's talking about.
By the way, I saw something, and I mentioned it to Denton. I don't know if I mentioned it to him on the air or off the air. Ty Felton, who was just an outstanding receiver this year in the Big Ten and for Maryland, I thought all year long, this guy looks like a night two pick, worst case. And I think a couple of, you know, during the season at some point, everybody was projecting him as a night two pick, a second or a third rounder. And I saw some full mock recently that had him in the sixth round on day three. You're a mock draft expert. What round does Ty Felton, the receiver from Maryland, get picked in?
Yeah, I mean, somebody suggested to me he could be a third-round pick, but before I came out here today and I was looking through some of the public, top 300 lists, things like that, he did seem to be further down. I mean, he obviously, was pretty prolific last year for the team as a Big Ten, within the Big Ten overall. I'll just say that, I'm sure there are other people I don't know, but like Keenan McCardle, who's the receiver coach for the Vikings, obviously former Washington player, he's here. The Commanders have a contingent of people here, and I haven't seen him, but I was told that Bobby Engram, their wide receiver coach, is here. So clearly there's some people here to get a look at him. They've got a couple other receivers as well, but he seems to be the one, and he's literally right now receiving punts, or catching punts, I should say. So, that's going to be a thing in Washington. Special teams coach Larry Izzo is also out here. So, I don't know. Maybe he does. Maybe his value is kind of all over the map. But, there's at least some scouts here to suggest that, he isn't just some random prospect that they'll, contemplate one day.
When schools are local to the professional football team, cost is no option at that point. Do you get a lot more people from, say, the front office or even the coaching staff to be at a Maryland pro day if you're Washington, or to be, at Pitt's pro day if you're the Steelers? Does that happen?
I think so. I mean, look, obviously, it's the schedule. It's not just this school, right? Like Penn State is having their pro day today simultaneously, and Penn State has the guy who could possibly be the number one, two, or three pick in the draft, Abdul Carter. They've got a tight end, Tyler Warren, who's projected to go, somewhere in the first round, and a lot of other guys. So I'm sure teams probably sent the majority or their main people there. But at the same time, I'm going to guess the Commanders have like 7 or 8 people here that I can tell. And I'm sure some of it is the local. I will say, previously, before this administration came in, I don't know if that was always the case. I was talking with another media person here that was saying that back in the day, I haven't come to all these Maryland pro days, but he's there were definitely years like one person from Washington was here. So I think the answer would be logically yes. You go to the ones that are local for, all obvious reasons, the travel, this, that, and the other. Timing has something to do with it. But, this team, this group definitely has some people here. And, Maryland doesn't have, they've got Jordan Phillips, the defensive lineman, who's another guy that potentially is going to be a day two pick. He's probably the biggest name here. And you mentioned Felton. That have some other interesting guys, but nobody off the chart. So this isn't a star-studded field, but still Washington has a lot of people here.
Right. We are talking to Ben Standing. So really quickly back to basketball, who do you, you texted me Donovan, who'd you like to see the Terps hire, or what would you like their mindset to be maybe?
Yeah. I mean, my point with Donovan was, I feel like the last few years in both sports, they've just felt to be too conservative. Going back to Turgeon, look, I'm not knocking Turgeon. I'm not knocking Willard. They're fine coaches, but it doesn't feel like their potential is necessarily, off the charts. I mean, it's so hard to know, right? I mean, Michigan was a horrendous team 1 year ago. Now they bring in Dusty May from Florida Atlantic, who had success in the tournament, got him to a Final Four, and now Michigan has a massive bounce back year, and, they're still going. Obviously what Rick Pitino has done with St. John, even with this crazy NIL era, you can turn things around.
Yep.
And I just feel like, because they're constantly dealing with economic issues, it's like the line when you go to Vegas, scared money don't make money. It just feels like they constantly lean into the more conservative option. And, I don't know if that mindset was the ADs or if that's coming from higher up because they want to take chances. But to me, I mentioned Billy Donovan, obviously a guy who won 2 titles at Florida, then went to the NBA. Take big swings. Go for it. And a big swing doesn't have to be a name. It could be the number one assistant for Danny Hurley, or take the risk of finding the next guy. It doesn't just have to be, this guy's won 20 games here, therefore he's the safe pick. No, I'd like to see them go forward. I don't necessarily know who that guy is, but I would rather them, like I said, take somebody's top assistant or take that kind of Billy Donovan swing versus just bringing in, you know, if I say Chris Collins, I don't want to be insulting to Chris Collins, but, you know, just bring in, you know, another Kevin Willard. Like, no, like go bigger. You're Maryland already. What are we doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're Maryland, what are we doing, isn't the same, doesn't have the same impact among the coaching community that it once did. But I Absolutely. Suggested earlier that maybe what Willard leaves on his way out, if indeed he's heading on his way out, is a new mindset in the athletic department and among the important people in the university when it comes to basketball. And the new coach might benefit from that. But I'm with you. I mean, I think I wanted them to think big last time. I was all in on Patino, but nobody, you know, seemed to think that that was possible because of the baggage. Well, you don't have to worry about baggage anymore. I mean, come on. I mean, this is, you know, this is pro ball basically now. And that's why I'd look at somebody like Chris Beard. I'd back the truck up for Chris Beard. I would, if Donovan wanted to coach in college basketball again, definitely. And, you know, Maryland's got, you know, there are some very redeeming traits about the Maryland job still that will never change. One is that they're in a very good basketball league. Two is they're in a fertile recruiting ground. And three, you know, is that they, you know, when you win, it's a big deal. But what hasn't been there has been sort of the internal stuff to go with it. And maybe now that'll change. We'll see. All right. I was going to ask you about a specific player. So I started last weekend, just briefly, I was looking at some of the edge players in the draft, which, by the way, we are 1 month away from knowing what happened in the first round, exactly 4 weeks away. Last night, 4 weeks would be the first round. And there was one player in just sort of watching, because I had never seen him play in college. He played at Marshall. But this dude, Mike Green, like, I've seen him in mocked as high as, like, 11 or 10. And then I've seen him mocked as low as, like, 27 or 28. He's an edge pass rusher from Marshall. He's lean. He is super twitchy, quick. He had 17 sacks last year, like 55 pressures or something like that, multiple forced fumbles. I'm curious as to how much you've done your first full mock, and your next one will be, I think, your last one on the entire first round. But how much of the edge players have you watched, and has anybody stood out to you? Because Mike Green stands out to me as a guy that could be maybe available.
Yeah, in terms of just, like, pure talent and athleticism and potential and all that, like, he's easily one of the names to watch in this draft. And just in terms of, like, you know, the tape and in terms of the production, like, he should be a top 15 pick and, you know, maybe even more than that. So there'll be a lot of defensive ends, edge rushers that are going to go in the first round. The question for him is sort of the interviews, the off-the-field stuff. I don't know all the details, but, like, he was at Virginia and basically was, you know, accused of, what was it, sexual assault, I want to say.
Okay.
And it was not I mean, he had some, you know, there were some issues.
Well, they're into this
led
stuff.
To him believing.
These are some of the tells on who they're going to pick, you know, RAS scores, team captains, you know, culture, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, no, like I said, in terms of the pure football stuff, it's obvious that he talked about this at the combine. He explained kind of a little bit what happened, and, you know, he's saying, hey, it didn't happen, and, you know, so on. And I don't believe he's actually ever been charged. My only point is to say these are the things that the teams have to study. You know, James Pierce Jr. from Tennessee is another guy where there's some, you know, notion of something, you know, some questions off the field, not in terms of the same stuff that I just mentioned with Green, but just, like, there's some background information that teams are going to have to get, and that's the part that makes it challenging, you know, for us. I mean, Pierce is another guy, like, the production numbers are pretty sick. He ran the fastest 10-yard split at the combine, and that's a stat that Adam Peters has really looked at over the years back to San Francisco that he looks for in the defensive linemen, guys that get off quick. But, again, you know, whatever their homework is going to be on a guy like that, and Green, you know, that's, you know, obviously for all the teams, that's going to, you know, tell a lot, you know, here. You know, the culture was obviously such a huge deal last year, and that's why you keep guys like Wagner and Ertz. But part of that culture is, what can you bring in some guys who maybe need to mature a little bit, or, you know, what have you, and can they help, can the culture that you're building help raise that? If you're confident in that, then, you know, maybe you're willing to overlook some questions. Where you know, if you're not, then maybe guys you stay away from. So the fact that Washington's, you know, the vibe here last year was so strong and they kept so many of the core pieces, you know, maybe they're open to taking a little more of gambles. I mean, obviously they did to some degree with, you know, Marshawn Lattimore, on some extent, you know, with Debo Samuel. You know, there were some, you know, issues last year with the 49ers, but, you know, these guys are vets, but on top of it, they think they have a good thing going here. So you can bring in guys that maybe, you know, in other situations you would say, I don't know if that's for us, but maybe you think, hey, great player. We think that, you know, we think there's a lot here to work with, and you know, we've got the right place to help this guy make a transition if we're talking about a draft pick.
All right, last one. Stanford all of the sudden has a head coaching opening because Troy Taylor, their coach, was fired. Some sort of hostile, aggressive behavior in the workplace issue. And Tavita Pritchard's name has been mentioned. He is the quarterback's coach here in Washington. I mean, it seems like a long shot to me that he would go from quarterback's coach to head coach of Stanford. But what do you think?
Well, right, he was the OC at Stanford, right? Right, but before he came to Washington, I want to say. He was a quarterback there. He was the quarterback, right, like after Andrew Luck. So he
was the quarterback after Andrew Luck. So he was the OC at Stanford. I know Pep Hamilton was the OC there for many years. He's at Maryland now. Okay, yeah.
Well, maybe Denton can double check me, but I know that's where
OC,
he was before,
OC and quarterbacks coach, 18 through 22, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, he is somebody from there. They obviously would know him.
Been on David Shaw's staff, I think.
Right, right. So, you know, obviously, you know, look, he's had, you know, some good experience here. He was one of the few coaches, and partly because he was under contract, but he was one of the few coaches that stayed on board with the Dan Quinn era. And, you know, they have a lot of people helping Jaden Daniels, but, you know, he's part of that, and obviously that's going to be a huge deal. I mean, look, he got an interview to be an OC this year with Jacksonville, and you don't get that interview. You know, part of it is obviously, I'm sure they seem to want to pick the brain of the people who are around Washington's success, but that's how a lot of these things go. So, yeah, it does seem like a long shot, but I don't know where Stanford's head's at, and maybe there's something to be said for, you know, somewhat like with Maryland, with the basketball, you know, coach, you know, going for a Dwayne Simpkins because he's an alum and he's in the area. There may be some appeal to that after, you know, sort of a rough situation here. Maybe Stanford has the same mindset. Let's bring in somebody that we know who knows what it means to be part of this culture. So, I mean, that could be interesting. And obviously Washington's been able to keep their whole staff essentially together, certainly on offense. And, you know, we'll see if Tavita's able to stick around or not.
Thank you. Have a good weekend. Enjoy the hoops. Enjoy good Maryland today. Beautiful day.
Good luck with your it's nice. Good luck with your coaching search.
Yeah. Ben Standing, everybody, at Ben Standing on X. When we come back, a lot of other things happened last night, including one of the wildest endings in recent NBA history. You'll hear the play-by-play of it when we return. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. All right, we talked about the Nats opening day loss to the Phillies when we started Denton's news at the end of last hour. Unbelievable pitching performance by Mackenzie Gore. But the Nats lost in 10, 7-3 to the Phillies. But God, there was a lot. Yesterday was one of those days, you know, to combined opening day and Sweet 16. But then here we had a couple of interesting games to talk about. And then there was an all-time ending in the NBA game. So I'll let you start where you want to start.
Well, yeah, so you mentioned a dominant performance from Mackenzie Gore. It was very less dominant from the Wizards' defense. They hosted the Pacers last night, and they got whooped. 162. Let me just say that again. 162-109. They lost by nearly 60 points. Embarrassing defensive performance from the Wizards.
I mean, Indiana had 125 points at the end of the third quarter. But here's the thing that I did not know until this morning. It was, by the way, the largest margin of defeat in Bullets Wizards franchise history, 53 points. The previous worst defeat was 52, set back on January 10th, 1971. Josh Robbins, who covers the team for The Athletic, tweeted it out. They were in Baltimore then. They weren't even in Washington or in Landover. They lost to the Bucks in 1971. That would have been a Lou Alcindor, I believe, Milwaukee Bucks team. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he would eventually become 151-99. They lost by 52 to the Bucks all the way back in 1971. They lost by 53 last night, 162-109. But how about this part of the story? In the Pacers, on the Pacers' final three offensive possessions, they took intentional shot clock violations. They didn't try to score in the final minute and a half of the game.
Embarrassing.
That is like, to be honest with you, that's showing it up even more. I think that's even more insulting if you're the Wizards.
Way worse than like a late game dunk when the game's put away.
I mean, that's like a mercy rule, you know, in a CYO game. Like, you know, they're up by 15, let's go to a running clock. I mean, this is the NBA. You kidding me? They had all their subs in there and they took three straight shot clock violations intentionally holding on to the ball? That is really insulting. These are professional players. And by the way, you probably had players in the game that haven't played a lot. Let them play. The Wizards had players, I'm sure, at the end of the game that haven't played a lot either. Let them play. The final minute 30. That's embarrassing. On one level, it's embarrassing to the Wizards, but it's really like, it's like Indiana was trying to emasculate the Wizards.
And they
up
succeeded.
53. I understand final possession, okay? There's you take over possession, 23 seconds left, and you dribble the clock out. But over the final minute, three straight shot clock violations? Intentionally taken?
Terrible.
That's crazy, man.
I don't know how you could let somebody do that to you as a professional basketball team.
162 points they gave up. Indiana shot 64.1% from the floor, 57.4% from behind the arc. They were 27 of 47 in the game. You would think, you know, that somebody on their team had some kind of massive game when you score 162. Haliburton, in just 25 minutes, remember they had lost the night before on a LeBron James tip-in at the buzzer. So they were playing the second of back-to-backs. Haliburton played just 25 minutes, scored 29 points. Nobody else on the roster scored more than 17, but they had, I think, 10 players or 9 players in double figures. What did they have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9 players in double figures in the game. I don't know, man. If that's good sportsmanship, change the definition in the NBA. I get it in the final, you know, 24 seconds, not the final minute and a half. You don't take three straight intentional shot clock violations. It's actually, to me, it comes off as more of trying to rub it in and show the opponent up. And they're professionals. This is not, you know, you're not playing, you know, a third grade game where, you know, really the third graders are like as old as fourth graders against kids that are closer to second graders, and you got a mercy rule. That's not what we're doing here.
Anyway. I'm going to stay NBA real quick because we have a little bit of breaking news. The Grizzlies, who are fifth in the West right now, just fired their coach.
Really?
Yeah, Taylor Jenkins, this according to Chris Haynes, Taylor Jenkins is now out in Memphis. They're fifth in the West right now. They have a 2.5-game lead over the Clippers. I mean, they haven't been, you know, playing spectacular as of late.
Yeah, tell me how they've been playing.
They're 5-5 in their last 10. You know, John Morant's been injured periodically, but they just fired their head coach.
I'll tell you what, for a lot of money, if you had said, do you know who Memphis who the head coach of the Memphis Grizzlies is, I don't think I could have pulled it.
You would have pulled out David Fizdale from like 6 years ago.
That, I don't even know if I would have pulled out Fizdale. But I'm pretty. How long's Taylor Jenkins been the coach? He's been the coach since 2019.
Yeah, he was the. Because remember, they got rid of the other guy. Not.
God, they are a nondescript professional sports franchise, even though they do have John Morant playing for them.
They really are. Yeah, I think the other guy was. It wasn't Dave Jagler, but his name looked like Dave Jagler's name. You know what I mean?
I can't pull it for the life of me. But Memphis, yeah, they've had a good season, and John Morant's had a good season. They've got they've got Jaren Jackson on that team. They're a good team. John Morant is a fun player to watch. I mean, he really is. But I could not have pulled Taylor Jenkins. Could not have pulled that. All right.
Could you have
That's
pulled
kind
a,
of breaking news.
That is kind of breaking news. Could you have pulled a 47-footer last night like Josh Giddey
this
did?
This was incredible, this ending.
So this was one of the wildest sequences I think I have ever seen in professional basketball. I'm actually going to give you the final 55 seconds, if that's okay.
The final 55. Wow. I've seen the final 55. Like 30, 15 or 20 seconds, not the final 55.
Yeah,
go
so
ahead,
let
give
me,
it to me.
Let me paint you the scenario.
Yeah.
The score is 115-110. Los Angeles leads Chicago with 12 seconds left to go in the fourth quarter, and this is how the final stretch of that game sounded.
Oh, whoa. You just told me you're going to give me the final 50 seconds of the game.
This is a 55-second video
clip.
Oh, but it's the final
you're
going to
show me, I've watched five times already. Yes, I've seen it from 115 to 110.
All right, then I can just give you the final call then.
No. I want to hear the we got to talk about what came before the final call. You're right. But when you said the final 50 seconds, I thought it was the final 50 seconds of the game.
No. This is just a 55 second
clip. Go ahead.
Clip.
Play what you were going to play, the 55-second clip.
Bulls have to hurry. Get it into Vucevic. Quick pass to Williams. Big shot for three. Good. Oh, wow. Two-point game, 9.8 left. Oh, who's ball? Giddey! The steal! Right for the lead! Yes!
Big-time players! Make big-time plays! Kobe, wait! Sub-zero! Bang, bang, bang!
What a wild sequence! And the cardiac... The final shot before that. Here's Reeves. Reeves straight to the cup. Lays it in to take the lead. Bulls are out of timeouts. 2 seconds left. Giddey for the win! Go!
Oh, my God! I cannot believe this! Elizabeth, I'm coming, baby!
Who is that guy? Elizabeth, I'm coming, honey. The line, by the way, is Elizabeth, I'm coming to join you, honey. Fred Sanford, 1970s. Who is that on the call for the Bulls?
I'm trying to find the name of their color guy. I'm pretty sure their play-by-play is Adam Amin. I'm trying to find the name of their color commentator.
So let me what you guys heard last night was Chicago hosting the Lakers, the Bulls and the Lakers. The Bulls have actually been playing much better recently. And the Lakers had a 115-110 lead with 12.1 seconds left. LeBron, this is a lot about LeBron over the final 12.1 seconds. He gets lost defensively on a three-point shooter, Patrick Williams, who knocks down a three with 7.1 seconds left, all right? With 10.1 seconds left. He then throws one of the worst inbounds passes. The Lakers had a timeout. They could have advanced the ball. It's 115-113 now, L.A. LeBron does what, you cannot do on an inbounds pass underneath the other team's basket. Against full court pressure. You can't throw the ball into the corner, and you can't look right at the guy you're throwing it to. LeBron made one of the worst inbounds decisions and passes that Josh Giddey, all right, good on you, mate, the Australian who played all of his career in OKC, I've always loved Giddey as a talent. He lost confidence. He lost his way in OKC. He's playing in Chicago now. Giddey steals the ball off a terrible pass by LeBron, feeds Kobe White, who knocks down a three with 6 seconds to go. It's now in 6 seconds, they've gone from down five to up one. Well, the Lakers advance the ball. Austin Reeves, I mean, they don't even check him. He drives to the rim, driving layup to give the Lakers the lead with 3.1. And then Josh Giddey on a pass back. He was the inbounder. It comes back to him. And with LeBron trying to contest the half-court shot, he drilled it at the buzzer. You're talking about in the final 12.1 seconds, the Bulls scored 9 points. The Lakers scored two. 11 points in the final 12.1 seconds with three threes by Chicago. A stunning finish. But LeBron, I haven't heard it. I didn't see any of the postgame sound. That's on LeBron. That was a terrible inbounds pass. For one of the highest IQ players that have ever lived, I don't know what he was doing. It was a terrible pass.
Terrible
by the way,
pass.
Is Josh Giddey good this year? I'm assuming that he's played. He had 25, 14, and 11 last night. He's always been super skilled and super talented.
He's averaging 14 a game, 14, 7,
that's
and
it.
7.
Okay.
Stacey King, by the way, is the color analyst.
That was Stacey King?
That's Stacey King for
wow.
Chicago.
Okay. That doesn't sound like Stacey King.
He's gotten older. Maybe he just really perfected his Australian accent.
He nailed it. Unbelievable finish. The other thing about this game, because I didn't watch it, but I read about the follow-up, is people in the NBA, you know, analyst world are just killing Luka. Because apparently the Bulls just down the stretch did nothing but target Luka Doncic, which we've seen before.
We see that every postseason.
Every postseason. I've said this before about Luka. I don't think he's incapable of being a better defensive player.
He doesn't want
to. He's got really good quickness, not speed or overwhelming athleticism, but he's got quick hands. He anticipates well. He just can't stay in front of anybody with the kind of effort he gives defensively. That's why this iteration of the Lakers is not going to win anything substantial. They can't stop anybody. At least Luka Denton in Dallas had some size behind him. Once somebody beat him off the dribble, there was at least a rim protector or two. LA doesn't have that.
No, he just doesn't give effort. Like you coached long enough to know defense is like 90% effort.
It's a big part of it.
Athleticism is nice, but you have to try, and he just doesn't try on defense.
He doesn't have any. I think, who said this about him? Was it Rick Carlisle? I forget who said this to him a couple of years ago. We just want you to participate.
That was
like,
Rick,
we just want you to participate on defense. That's all we're asking. We know you can get us 60 if we need it on offense. We just need some participation from you on defense.
Because LeBron is the same way a little bit. You know, he just doesn't. He'll give you some highlight plays on defense, but for a 48-minute
LeBron
stretch,
can lock you down if he wants to.
Yeah, but he hasn't done it in years. He's not going to be your primary defender. I know that's the problem. You're pairing a 42-year-old LeBron 40, with a guy in Luka Doncic that does not want to play defense, and then you don't have size to protect the rim. You're playing with a hand and a foot tied behind your back.
Yeah.
Because at least with Anthony Davis, you had a legitimate, you know, defensive player of the year candidate. We just don't have that anymore.
Yeah.
Speaking of the NBA, Adam Silver said that he was pausing any talks of expansion, because we need more NBA teams, until the Celtics deal is finalized. The rumored price is that they were sold for $6.1 billion. We got that news, I think, 2 weeks ago now.
What are the expansion cities that they're talking about?
I mean, I imagine Seattle would be one of them, and Vegas might be another.
Right.
Those would be the top two. I would say just move a team. I mean, let's be honest. Do we need a team in Memphis?
They don't have anything else.
They don't have any. Do they need any? They got Penny Hardaway. Like, take that team. Everyone's talking about moving the team out of Dallas. Why would you move the team out of the Dallas-Fort Worth market? It's one of the top 7-8 markets in the country.
Who's talking about moving Dallas?
That's what there's been talk after they traded Luka about potentially them becoming an expansion team in Vegas or something like that.
Right.
But I would move it out of Memphis and then put it in Vegas or Seattle. Seattle. Seattle would be my first choice. The NBA is probably going to go Vegas first because of money. But Seattle is a great NBA
team. Here's the thing about the Memphises and the Salt Lakes and the Portlands and, you know, I'm probably missing one or two. They sell out every night. They're successful franchises with massive followings. You can't get a ticket to an OKC game.
I'm not saying move OKC. Keep OKC. But you get the same thing in Seattle.
Yeah. I forget what it was like in Seattle at the end. I mean, they had a very, very young KD. I know what it was like for Seattle at one point. I mean, when the last time our NBA franchise was good, Seattle was really good. They played, believe it or not, Denton, you're nowhere near even a thought at this point. They played in back-to-back NBA finals. I mean, there was a rivalry. It was the Supersonics and the Bullets. They played in back-to-back NBA championship series. The Bullets won in 78 in a seventh game on the road. I think still the only, other than the Cleveland team that won at Golden State with Kyrie hitting the shot, I think those are the only two road game seven winners in an NBA Finals history. You can look that up. I might be outdated on that one. Maybe something happened in the last couple of years, but I'm pretty sure those are the only two. And then they lost in five the next year as the defending champions. They won 60 games and lost in five games. I mean, they were out of gas by the time they got there because they had gone to seven in the conference semifinals and seven in the Eastern Conference Finals. But the Seattle fans, they played some of the games in the finals in the Kingdom because the demand was so high. But that's,
all right, I'm going to take back my Memphis comment because I'm looking at some of their home games, and they didn't sell out against the Jazz, but they got 16,000 people
in
the arena
against
the Jazz.
They draw really well.
I don't know when the last time the Wizards got 16,000 people at Cap 1 was, so I'll take my comments back on Memphis.
I bet the Wizards have gotten 16,000. The Wizards, I'm actually sometimes surprised at how many people are at Wizards games.
Let's see, last night in the beatdown, there was 15. Huh, not bad.
Yeah, I'm consistently surprised. I think the Wizards are probably near the bottom in average attendance, but still, the NBA does pretty well attendance-wise. Their issues are TV ratings.
Anyway. Yeah, I'm going to guess the ratings were not very good for the Wizards last night because you also had the Capitals in action. They lost 4-2 to the Minnesota Wild. No goals for Ovi. It was the last time that Alex Ovechkin faced off against Marc-Andre Fleury, who's a longtime goaltender of the Pittsburgh Penguins. I remember him best when he was in net when the Capitals won against the Golden Knights.
Right.
Love that. That's probably his career high. At least it is for me. But this is the final time these two guys are going to play. Fleury's 40 years old, and this is his last year.
Well, look, I watched this early this morning. Alex Ovechkin, literally, as the game ended, went and pulled some of his players who were heading towards the locker room back out onto the ice to go and shake hands with Marc-Andre Fleury, who everybody believes is in his final season of his career. And I had no idea about the Marc-Andre Fleury, you know, respect around the league. He apparently is one of the most respected and well-liked players in the league. And Ovechkin obviously played all of these games against Marc-Andre Fleury when he was in Pittsburgh and then when he was in Vegas. 28 goals in 47 games against Fleury. Ovechkin called some of the key players, including John Carlson and a few others, back out onto the ice to go shake his hand. It was, I mean, I don't know, man. Sometimes I think you only get this in hockey. I mean, I'm not just talking about at the end of a playoff series, but what a classy thing to do by Alex Ovechkin. Now, what I learned after watching this video is that this is happening in other places for Marc-Andre Fleury around the league. Dylan Strome last night, who played with Fleury at one point in his career, said everyone knows he's one of the best people of all time in the game. So the little respect we can show him at the end of the game, I think, goes a long way. The Minnesota Wild, they were impressed. Their coach said, quote, every team we go to, you see the signs. Everybody loves him, and everybody loves playing against him. I don't think you could find one person to say anything bad about him. And then somebody else said it was just awesome to see. But it was Ovechkin. The team had just lost 4-2. They were heading off the ice, and he said, whoa, wait a minute. And the video's out there. He pulls everybody back out onto the ice to go say and send their best to Marc-Andre Fleury, who was on the bench. He didn't play last night for Minnesota. I don't know, man. Sometimes I think the only time you see stuff like this is in hockey. But classy move by Ovechkin, who obviously has bigger things on his mind right now, but remembered him. All right, what else?
Final thing here before we talk about the games last night and today, you get the Terps. Lady Terps in action tonight against South Carolina, tip at 5.
Yeah, I think they are a 17-point underdog. I think I read that. Rooting for the Terps, but this apparently is South Carolina's pretty rough.
Yeah, 17.5-point underdog.
They're really good.
That's a very large. That's the largest line of the weekend.
It is
for the women.
In women's.
Yeah, UConn is 14.5 over Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Man, we didn't talk about this a lot the other day, but Juju Watkins. Maybe we did. Being out, because that was a matchup right this weekend that would have had, or maybe Monday night. It was a potential Elite Eight matchup between SC and UConn, I believe, in the women's bracket. And that was going to be a big-time matchup. You know, we the other day we were talking about the increased ratings of this tournament, the men's tournament. The ratings are up big-time from last year in particular. I'm telling you, a big part of it is because last year, remember, we made a big deal out of the women's Final Four, the Elite Eight game that Caitlin Clark was involved in, outrating any of the men's games. You don't have that. And some of these games, by the way, are being played on the same days, same nights, same times. And last year, the women's tournament did better on certain nights than the men's tournament. Well, you don't have that this year. That's not happening this year. So that's part of why the numbers are back up big time for the men's tournament. Yeah, I'm looking at the bracket right now. USC and UConn would have been set to play Monday night. That would have been a big time, you know, matchup. UConn and USC in an Elite Eight game. Paige Beckers against Juju Watkins had she stayed healthy. All right, we'll talk about the Sweet 16 games, the other games last night. I've got a smell test, too, when we come back. Oh, for last night, I had Texas Tech in Maryland. I'm now 9-9-1 for the tournament. And on a bit of a cold streak here, 1-5 in the last six plays. That always makes you a little bit gun-shy, but you got to stick with your philosophy, because it's proven over time to win more than it loses, even counting VIG, even counting juice. I still say that this is for entertainment purposes only. I like Ole Miss tonight. People are on Michigan State. I'll take Ole Miss plus the 3.5, and a lot of people like Michigan, public bettors like Michigan tonight, so I'll lay the 9 with Auburn. Those are the two plays. Real quickly, so again, Ole Miss plus 3.5, Auburn minus 9. 4 SEC teams playing tonight, 3 Big Ten teams playing tonight, and then you also have Houston. Wait a minute. How many Big East did I say? How many SEC? 1, 2, 3, 4 SEC, 3 Big Ten. Yeah, in Houston. Those are the 8 teams playing tonight. Last night, Cooper Flagg put on an unbelievable performance. 30 points, 6 rebounds, 7 assists, and 3 block shots in Duke's win over Arizona, 100-93. It was one of the greatest all-around tournament performances ever. 35-5, at least 30 points, 5 rebounds, and 5 assists in an NCAA tournament game became an official stat in 1984. According to ESPN research, he became just the second player with a game like that in the NCAA tournament. The other player to do it was Ed O'Bannon for UCLA all the way back in 1994. And he also became the first player with 35-5 and one or fewer turnovers in a game. The last guy to do that, or since, Chris Mullin did it in 1985. You know what's, in watching Cooper Flagg over the last month more closely than the first few months of the season, he just has unbelievable basketball IQ. Just incredible feel. And he is so unselfish. He got 30 last night, but on 19 field goal attempts. You know, he didn't need 25. He had 7 assists, 6 rebounds, 3 blocks, 1 steal, and 1 turnover in the game. Duke, we talked about the points in college basketball this year. Man, they are up big time, and we've seen it in some of these tournament games. Alabama with the second most points ever in a tournament game beat BYU 113-88, and they set the record for made threes in an NCAA tournament game. They were 25 of 51. Mark Sears himself, 10 of 16. Okay, 51 of their 66 field goal attempts were threes. Alabama, they can't guard anybody, but man, they can score. The Alabama-Duke game on Saturday night is going to be fun to watch. All right, enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the hoops. Chris is up next.